Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. My name is Philip Matari and I work in the Norwegian Military Academy. Last year I received a scholarship from the Norwegian Army and studied here at King's, where I wrote the thesis on how to teach tactics. Earlier this year I also completed a graduate level course on pedagogy. During this presentation, I will link contemporary pedagogical principles with wargaming. Hopefully this will give wargaming supporters some other arguments than the usual ones concerning analytical simulation and quantitative data. This story begins during a study trip to Quantico and the schools there. One of the first things I was told about the purpose of the schools was that they taught good judgment. As the curious student I am, I asked how, to which they had no real answer apart from taking part in their curriculum. The U.S. Marine Corps teaching methods felt right, but why this was so was much harder to answer. This is a familiar issue. Military teaching is usually based on anecdotal evidence or on incremental evolutions of the curriculum. My contribution is a set of indicators to measure the quality of teaching, especially within tactics. The findings might seem obvious to many. That's because good teaching feels good. The indicators, however, will help explain this good feeling. Before we proceed, I need to point out that I view tactics as a cognitive skill. Since every battle is unique, the commander needs to apply reason in order to decide on his course of action. Which battle drills to use at what time and in what terrain. So, how to teach a cognitive skill? Here are the three indicators I have identified. First, judgment, which needs to be shaped and honed. Second, speed, in which you need to verify your intuitive decisions. And third, guile, in which you need to break with your norms and assumptions. I will now talk about each one in order, beginning with a quick lesson in pedagogy. Let me give you a condensed summary of contemporary pedagogical principles. First, it is students themselves, in the end, not teachers, who decide what students will learn. Let me illustrate. A teacher cannot upload knowledge like you upload a picture to the internet. The student needs to construct this picture on their own. Second, in order to understand whether the students are constructing the knowledge correctly, they need proper feedback. The more timely and objective, the better. This means that the purpose of teachers is to make tasks that help students construct knowledge. John Hattie, in the picture, a renowned professor of education from New Zealand, calls this triggering students' cognitive engagement. He sums his theory up in the following citation. When teachers see learning through the eyes of the student, and when students see themselves as their own teachers. To help understand what being cognitively engaged feels like, John Hattie says that it is when you experience hurting thinking. And he equates this to Daniel Kahneman's cognitive process called System 2. There is a scientific consensus that humans think in two manners, intuitively and analytically. One acknowledged model is Kahneman's System 1 and 2, where the former is intuitive and System 2 is analytical. System 1, in purple, is an automatic, fast, and often unconscious way of thinking. It is autonomous and efficient, requiring little energy or attention, but it is prone to systematic errors and biases. System 2, in green, is an effortful, slow, and controlled way of thinking. It requires energy and can't work without attention. But once engaged, it has the ability to filter the instincts of System 1. Learning a skill, in our case, a cognitive skill, tactics, requires transforming System 2 processes, the green ones, into System 1 processes, into the purple area. And as John Hattie has underlined, it is by making students become cognitively engaged, or more crudely, making them use hurting thinking. The time required to transform System 2 into System 1 is subjective, but there are averages. Driving lessons are required to take your driver's license, and the number of lessons is pretty average, but some require less, some require more. In the Army, when we teach shooting skills, completing firing tables 1 through 20 will yield a certain type of soldier. This brings us to the first indicator. The first indicator of good teaching in tactics is an awareness in developing judgment. Educational methods should make students cognitively engaged use system two, and provide them with quality feedback. Getting students into hurting thinking can be done in many ways. For example, through Socratic questioning, where the student becomes aware of his knowledge through discussion with an adept teacher, or by using argumentation, especially in writing. Here, the student must justify his actions with his own words and thus becomes aware of his own thoughts. Arguments can also be visualized with, for example, Stephen Toulmin's model, so they become easier to take apart and discuss. Within tactics, judgment is thus shaped through the repeated analysis of history, experiences of cases, and it is honed by applying your judgment to various problems, such as tactical problems, field exercises, tactical decision games, and war games. On to the second indicator. The second indicator involves speed. NATO doctrine is the maneuverist approach. This doctrine decentralizes decision-making and emphasizes speed. The goal is to decide faster than the enemy in order to cause a moral collapse and reduce his will to fight. However, quick decision-making is intuitive decision-making. And as we have seen, system one is prone to biases and systematic errors. As the top infographic shows, 95% of our decisions are made intuitively, and only 5% analytically. This is because our mind uses heuristics. These mental shortcuts are efficient mental processes that help humans solve problems and learn new concepts. These processes make problems less complex by ignoring some of the information that's coming into the brain, either consciously or unconsciously. However, these mental shortcuts are based on experience. Thus, the quality of intuitive decisions depend on your level of expertise. Since we don't fight every day, our system one is filled with very poor experiences. That means our decisions in battle will be based on very poor data. System one is also prone to bias and systematic errors. For example, confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is the tendency to search for, interpret, favor, and recall information in a way that affirms one's own prior beliefs or hypotheses. Another bias is cognitive ease. When we think we are right and we feel certain, we experience a sense of cognitive ease. The world makes sense to us, and that puts us in a good mood. Cognitive ease feels good, but it gives a false sense of security because it makes us think we understand far more than we actually do. In order to retain speed and decision-making, we need to use system one because it's quick, but we need to verify the decision with system two. This is not a natural way of doing things. However, it can be overcome with training. So in this picture, two of my cadets, the one on the left is the platoon commander and the one on the right is the second in command. And the platoon commander, just before this picture, was calling for fire on a position just ahead of us. I asked him how you know this is far enough ahead in order to keep within security measures. And he said, I just know this, I can see this, this is this distance. He felt that he knew that this was true. And then I asked him, how can you verify that you know this is right? And he didn't really have any suggestions. So I called up on his second in command, who brought out the map and measured with his compass. And it turned out that we were in fact too close to the target to be allowed to call for fire. So another way to verify your system one is thinking about what you did not choose. So what courses of action am I not choosing? That means you can snap out of your confirmation bias and your cognitive ease and think about all the different solutions you have before you. On to the last indicator, and maybe the most interesting one. According to Lawrence Freeman, force versus guile is the most powerful dichotomy in all strategic thought. Force seeks victory in the physical domain through direct methods, whilst guile pursues victory in the mental domain through indirect methods. Are you Achilles or are you Odysseus? As the story goes, Troy was not destroyed by force, but rather by guile in the form of Odysseus' Trojan horse. During my studies, I read military manuals as far back as I could find them, and I noticed that chapters concerning guile were particularly valuable to the authors. I found the same chapters conserved through many centuries. This indicates that it was important for ancient Europeans to make their military leaders aware of their own limitations regarding guile. They're making their leaders aware of their intuitive decisions. So, it's pretty obvious that being clever is clever, but in our society, it's not that obvious in practice. We grew up in societies that foster rule-based thinking. Armies are huge bureaucracies with endless rules that kill creativity and enforce groupthink. Doctrine often becomes dogma. My cadets are often much more clever before they enter the military academy. In Norway, every kid knows how to behave in a snowball fight in order to win, but not so much when they start planning military operations. Using guile is exploiting other people's predictability, using the poor quality of judgment against them, exploiting the fact that most people are making decisions within System 1. Military literature that we subjectively feel is of good quality fulfills many of the indicators I have just mentioned. While they might not have been aware of the pedagogy involved, the authors did it right. They want to help the reader change the way he thinks, and they do so through repetition and feedback. They are activating the reader's hurting thinking. The books I found start off with Moltke the Elder, and he wrote the two models that exist and that people have drawn inspiration from. The top model, I call the tasks, and that involves concrete tasks where you must argue for your decision. And in the books, there are no right answers, just better arguments. The second model is dreams. Dreams in which you must follow successively more complicated thought processes. The most famous book here is The Defense of Duffer's Drift, top right, where a young officer is on his way to the front in South Africa and is dreaming about how he's going to solve the defense of a stream. And each dream he fails, except the last one, and that's when he disembarks the train and does it correctly. Wargaming ticks the boxes for all these indicators. Wargaming is very good at triggering cognitive engagement. I am sure we all felt this in yesterday's games fair. Feedback is immediate and to the high degree objective. Second, wargaming can help you train yourself to verify and question your gut feeling. You can train yourself to check the solution proposed by System 1 with your System 2. What actions have I not considered? And finally, wargaming makes you aware of the box you are thinking within. Why is this relevant today? Since our adversaries are becoming near peer and peer adversaries, we need to rely on something else than technology. And as the former General Perkins said, former commander of TRADOC, it's hard to steal training and leadership because you can't fit it onto a thumb drive. To finish off, the obligatory Clausewitz quote, thank you for your attention.